supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Well, this is the time of year when every gardener's mind turns to sweet corn. It's one of the ultimate treats of summer, but it's getting harder and harder to find clean fertilizers to feed that hungry, hungry crop. We'll tell you in the question of the week the best ways to get that essential nitrogen to your essential sweet corn. Start warming up the butter. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens. You know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping it. 1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Jack. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Huntingdon, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. Just outside of Philadelphia, right?
No, sorry. It's just outside of State College. It's right in the middle of the state.
Oh, I was thinking of Huntington Valley. Yes, our State College listeners. No. What a responsive...
Yeah, near there.
Yeah, what a responsive group you are. Really, we're getting so many phone calls and emails. It's very nice to know there's that many gardeners in the middle of Pennsylvania.
Yep, for sure. We do our best.
Okay, what can we do for Jack near State College?
Well, I have a favorite flower that I like to have in the garden. It's also a wildflower around here called butterfly weed, Asclepias tuberosa. Mm-hmm. It has a beautiful orange blossom, and it really attracts butterflies. And mine have been blooming and doing quite nicely, but as soon as they bloom, it just looks as though something is attacking them and eating the buds and the leaves. And they're not producing the nice big seed pods that they should. It's a member of the milkweed family.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't find any sign of an insect or any kind of creature that's eating them. I just wondered what it might be.
Well, you want creatures to be eating the leaves, right? Because they're a host plant for monarch and other butterfly caterpillars.
Yes. If I saw those, I'd feel relieved, but I don't see anything.
Now, you have multiple varieties of milkweed, essentially, let's just call it that, in different parts of your property. And are you saying that these plants have mostly self-seeded, that they've just, the seed pods have dropped and sprouted new plants?
Yes, they have.
Now, is there something different about the location of the plant that's not doing well? Is it lower? Does it get excessive water? Does that area not drain well? Is it by the drain spout of a house or something?
No, they're on a hill, and it's extremely well drained. This plant seems to do very well in terrible soil.
That's one of the secrets of good propagation, of keeping these plants healthy, like raspberries. Don't feed them. Don't give them good soil. So there's nothing different about the location. It doesn't get less sun.
They get the same amount of sun.
And the flowers kind of do open up, but then something attacks them, or even the buds are smaller.
As soon as they're finished flowering and the flowers contract, then the leaves start to disappear. And the one I'm looking at is just nothing but a naked stem. It doesn't have any seed pods on it. And it's the tallest one that I have.
And again, there's no chance that the host caterpillars are on this thing doing what they're supposed to be doing.
I looked at them really closely. I just can't find any sign of a caterpillar or a worm or anything like that.
Okay. Have you gone out at night to see if there's something about this plant that slugs are going crazy on?
You know, it just occurred to me. That's the one time I haven't set the alarm and gotten up at night to see if slugs are doing it.
You don't even have to do that. Here's what you do. On the next night when it's not going to rain, at like 6 o'clock in the evening, I want you to crack open a beer. You are welcome to taste the beer to make sure we want it to be nice and fresh and yeasty. and then go out to the plant that's affected and fill up little margarine tubs, little half pint containers with the fresh beer as the sun is going down, and check them in the morning. There might be something about this area where slugs are hiding in a nearby mulch pile or something and escaping your attention, and they only come out late at night, and they tend to retract and get out of the way before people get up in the morning. But they can't resist yeast, and they will crawl into the little beer trap and be drowned by the alcohol. And then if it is slugs, there's like a million slug cures on our website. That's my best thought. If you can't see caterpillars, what you're describing sounds like slug damage.
That's great. I'll definitely follow up on that. And there are some beers I've tasted that really ought to be used as slug bait, too.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, that was that was the old line when I started gardening and I told somebody I had slugs. He goes, Iron City, three cases for $10 and you get change.
That's great.
All right, Jack,
okay,
good
Mike,
luck.
Thank you so much.
And enjoy your butterflies. I hear this was a great year.
It is. It's marvelous. Thanks again.
All right,
bye-bye.
Take care, sir. 1-888-346-9499. Elizabeth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
And welcome to you.
Well, I'm always welcome. It's my studio. I, you know, kind of make the ink here. How are you, Elizabeth?
Good.
And where is Elizabeth good?
In Princeton, New Jersey.
Oh, I love that area there. That is a great part of the Northeast. What can we do for Elizabeth in Princeton?
Well, I had called because you mentioned plantain, and in the historical record, it is referred to by the Native Americans as white man's footprint, because the white settlers, both to Canada and to America, brought the seeds with them as forage for their cattle and planted it. And then, of course, as we can see, it grows everywhere.
Okay, so, and this was also the plant that I was incapable of pronunciating correctly.
Well, I'm not sure I'm pronunciating it correctly either.
I think you are. I think you are. I think somebody came up to me at an event and said, stop calling that broadleaf weed plantain, because it's actually called plantain.
Yeah, and I think plantain is the banana.
Yes, exactly. So this is a deliberately imported plant.
Plant, yes. They brought the seed for forage for their cattle. And you can see why, because it grows so successfully.
And is it good forage?
I looked it up, and you can eat the leaves in salad.
Oh, okay.
You can eat the stems, either raw or cooked. And you could roast the seeds.
Oh, I'll bet you could.
I actually do spring and fall salads with stuff in the garden, which I truly enjoy doing.
Oh, you mean you do a spring tonic? You use wild plants as well?
Well, no, just the stuff that's escaped to grow in my lawn. You know, all the violets and all the, it's escaping me, all the things I eat, but we do eat them all.
Wild violets are one of the best sources of rutin, R-U-T-I-N, a very hard to get nutrient that strengthens our capillary walls. And the same is true of all members of the viola family. Violas themselves.
Yeah, because I eat all of those.
Johnny Jump Ups. Well, wild violets are like the original. And as my friend Jim Duke, the medicinal plant expert, would always say, the wild plant always has more phytonutrients than the cultivated version, like pansies.
Well, I've always eaten pansies, you know, after the first blush.
Yes.
After you bring them home to make sure that they're not ones that have been sprayed, the flowers haven't been sprayed.
You should always assume they were sprayed. So when I buy a flat, I pull off all the flowers and then I'll eat like the second or third run.
Yeah, that's sort of the basic sort of thing that I do. And then the other thing is that I have been burning I have a brick path and a brick driveway, and I've been burning my dandelions. Tops and the and trying to get them to die, stress out and die. And everybody thought I was crazy until they heard you say that that was a perfectly permissible way of getting rid of weeds, was to keep cutting off the greenery.
And if you're going to use a flame weeder on dandelions, you want to deliberately let some form the puffballs, and then you get munchkin fireworks when you hit them.
Well, I live right on the main street, and so everybody sees me out there with my flame burner. This little old lady and her flame burner are quite a sight in town.
I always tell people like you, they already think you're crazy, so just lean into it. You know.
My husband always was sorry that you couldn't buy titles in this country, because he said your idiosyncrasies would come off so much better if you were the Dowager Duchess of so-and-so.
Well, we may make you the Princess of Princeton or something.
Exactly. But I love your program, as do we all.
What a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll not only be talking about fall planting at 1 o'clock this Sunday, August 25th, at Willow Oaks Farm in Bear, Delaware. I'll be handing out tons of seeds for you to plant your fall garden. And it's all free. That's Celebrating Gardening second season at 1 o'clock this Sunday, August 25th, at Willow Oaks Farm in Bear, Delaware. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to correctly and safely fertilize that sweet, sweet, sweet corn of summer. I'm Super Sweet Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that late summer is the time to prepare to plant garlic and spring bulbs and to start pansies, salad greens, broccoli, and other cool weather lovers. Learn more at burpee.com. You Bet Your Garden host Mike McGrath will lead a small group of adventurous plant lovers on a culturally rich tour of the gardens of Cuba this coming January. Details at earthboundexpeditions.com. Earthbound Expeditions supports You Bet Your Garden.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and coming up later in the show, we're going to celebrate one of the favorite treats of summer when we talk about how to safely and correctly fertilize that hungry, hungry sweet corn that we're all hungry for. But mostly, we're taking your fabulous phone calls up to then at 1-888-346-9499. Ellie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Ellie. How are you?
I'm good.
And where is Ellie good?
So we're in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia.
So what can we do for Ellie in Huntington Valley?
So this is the first year that we planted a vegetable garden. My husband built cedar boxes, raised beds, and we got organic soil mixed with compost to fill the beds, and we were trying to do everything right. And we've had a lot of production this year, and the vegetables have tasted great and look great, and everything's been wonderful. Until about a week ago, my neighbor told me that he sprayed a chemical herbicide on the bordering brush of the, like, right next to the garden, well, about 5 feet away from the vegetable garden. So I just want to know if it's safe to eat the vegetables and to give to our kids.
What does the vegetation he sprayed look like?
Everything is dead and brown at this point.
So you see the swath of death he caused?
Yes.
Did any death appear in your raised beds?
It doesn't seem to be. It's, I mean, there's some leaves of our tomatoes and things that are turning, but it's, I believe it's more due to the time of year than anything, I'm hoping, but I don't see any, like, real brown on our, on the vegetables that are growing. So.
That's a good sign. That's a very good sign. Now, long term, you want to come to some sort of agreement with him. You need to tell him, don't do that again, please, you know, or else we're going to put up a giant spite fence. And if there's a plant that you think needs to be taken care of, tell us. We'll pull it up for you, or we'll mow it for you. I found the one answer for this is, tell me before you do anything, before you spray anything over there, and we'll handle it differently.
Right.
Are they decent neighbors besides?
Yeah, I mean, they are, and we do get along with them, so I'd hate to have this.
Good. Well, give them a couple of tomatoes and say, please don't try to poison these, okay? Now,
okay.
Has it rained heavily since then?
It has, yeah.
That's the
best rainy season.
That's the best thing that can happen when there is possible contamination like this. If it had not rained, I would have wanted you to get out there and really keep saturating the area, water the area, spray it down every morning. I mean, it's just basic common sense. You're just diluting it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think hopefully it sounds like he did not overspray very much. And because he used an herbicide, I don't think your vegetables are affected. There's not going to be time for anything to come up through the roots. He would have had to pour the liquid into your raised beds to really make a systemic, have a big effect. Obviously, mm-hmm. you want to wash them off really carefully. This time of year, yellowing leaves on tomatoes are absolutely to be expected, especially lower down on the plant.
Right.
I think you're fine, but you got to come up with a long-term plan. You really got to make the peace there. Because if not, you're going to have to move these things away from there and put a fence up or something terrible.
Right. That's true. Okay.
But take over some tomatoes, explain your situation, and maybe common sense will prevail.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Good luck, Ellie.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Terry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you, Mike. I appreciate you taking my call. I have a pink flowering dogwood in my backyard in eastern North Carolina here, and I planted it a year ago. It came out fine and leafed out, had one or two blossoms on it, even though it was a new plant. And then about probably the end of June, first part of July, the leaves started to turn dark, and then they started to dry up from the bottom up, and gradually they pretty much just all dried and fell off. I thought maybe it went dead, but I left it in, and this spring it leafed out again and came out fine. It did not bloom, but now the leaves have turned dark again and gone out. I have white dogwoods in the yard and another red dogwood that are established. And I've had no problem with this, but this one particular pink dogwood has started to do this.
Okay.
I'm not certain whether it's a fungus or whether it's just something in the tree itself.
Well, there is a fungal disease that has been claiming dogwoods for many years now. If you're experienced with them, you know they're picky plants. They want the right location and the right care. Now, when you planted the dogwood, was it in a pot or was it bald and burlapped?
It was a potted plant, and when I planted it, I know our soil here tends to be a little sandy, and I did plant it near probably where it might be near one of my leach lines. I'm not sure when we bought this house it had some work done on our septic system prior to us buying the house, and I did hit a little bit of limestone rock, a few pieces here and there when I was digging the hole, but when I planted it, I planted it, and I put Miracle-Gro type potting soil all around it to around in the hole and around the sides when I backfilled it rather than use the sandy soil. And it thrived. It did well that first year. And then since then, it's both years now. It's leafed out and done, looked like it was fine. And then now it has just turned and the leaves turn black and then they start to dry up and fall off.
Well, first of all, you're not supposed to improve the soil in the planting hole, and you're certainly not supposed to improve the soil of a dogwood with chemical fertilizer. So that's kind of two strikes against it. Does it get morning sun, and then does it get some afternoon shade?
No, it's in an open yard. That was one reason we planted it. We had some other trees removed.
Dogwoods are always going to suffer. The further south they go, the more they desperately need afternoon shade. Dogwoods in the wild are understory plants. They don't get a lot of sun, and they really can't stand broiling full sun. If your other trees are enduring that, I can't explain why. But a dogwood should always be planted high in the ground, should always be out in the open to get as much air circulation as possible to prevent these diseases from getting hold. And they need acidic soil, and they need a respite from the afternoon sun. Now, is this plant mulched, or have you fed it?
I haven't done any more feeding to it, no. And no, it isn't mulched. It has the lawn around it.
Oh, okay. And what do you feed the lawn?
Usually a regular commercial or grade wheat and feed is what I put on the lawn. I have a centipede yard, so it needs quite a bit of feeding.
Okay. You realize the herbicides in that are meant to kill trees and other plants, anything that's not grass?
Yes, but it doesn't hurt the other plants. I keep it away from them.
And that high nitrogen fertilizer is very bad for these plants as well. You're saying the grass grows right up to it?
Yeah, the grass grows up to it.
That's probably as far from an ideal situation as you can get. And I'm guessing if it's near your leach field of your septic system, the roots are probably being constantly wet and never being allowed to dry out. If you want to try to save this tree, I would wait until the, quote, winter time, which I realize isn't as dormant as my winter is, and I would move it away from the leach field. You got to be careful. You don't want to be planting anything near a leach field because you can damage the field. And you know that can run into big money. But it would like to be situated away from lawn chemicals and in a place where it gets some afternoon shade. Luckily, it doesn't sound like the disease has attacked it yet, but you're attacking it every time you feed an herbicide your lawn. I can't explain why the others are surviving it, but it is not good for them. It's also not good for you, because I can tell if you got a septic system, you're probably also on a well, and you really might want to look into non-toxic ways to treat your lawn. And it's always a good idea with any tree to have at least a foot or two of open space underneath so that the roots of the grass aren't stealing nutrients and, you know, really strangling the roots of the tree.
Okay. Now, I think my wife did put pine straw around it to mulch it here the other day, but it's just been recently.
That's good. Yeah, it needs acidic soil. So if you're going to move this, when you replant it, I would just fill the hole with the same soil, because otherwise the roots stay in that nice island of soil, and you really want them to move out into the rest of the landscape. It sounds like you did that differently with this tree than the others. And then you want to mulch it with some peat moss, milled peat moss, and then cover that with some pine straw or some compost. Keep the soil nice and acidic and give it a break from that afternoon sun. You wouldn't want to be sanding out in that sun all day, Terry.
Okay. Okay, yeah, my other dogwoods are along a fence line where there are taller plants or pine trees above them, and with the exception of the one that's between the houses, it probably gets a certain amount of shade from my house and my neighbors. So that's probably why the redwoods survived.
Yeah, that is like the first thing I learned about dogwoods: morning sun and afternoon shade. All right, sir.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
okay,
good luck.
Thank you. That was the answer I needed.
All right,
okay,
good luck, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Becky, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. I'm going to college later this month. I'll be leaving behind some plants because I cannot take my entire container garden with me.
Right.
Basically, it's one amaryllis plant that became 30. How do I prepare them for overwintering over the semester? Because my parents are probably not going to remember to water them.
Okay, so where are we? Where are we talking about?
I'm from New Hope. I'm going to Arcadia University. Ironically, I'm going to be taking plant biology.
But not your plants. Now,
I'm going to be taking a few of them. I'm taking Christmas cactus, spider plant, and one of the aloe plants is coming with me. Everything else is staying home. It's pretty much all amaryllis plants.
Oh, okay. Amaryllis is what you are leaving back at home.
Right.
I think you've chosen wisely. Now, interestingly enough, early September, sometime in the next couple of weeks, is actually indoor plant week, or words to that effect, where they're celebrating the ability of indoor house plants to help filter contaminants and pollutants out of a room and provide naturally fresher air. And the spider plant you're taking to college with you is one of the champs at that. But just the more living things you have in your dorm room, the better the air is going to be, and probably the better you'll feel. You'll have, unless, of course, they all die on you or something, but it'd be like having a cat that you don't have to change the litter box waiting for you when you go back to your room.
Pretty much.
And you're going to be leaving how many amaryllis bulbs back home?
It started as one. It is now 30 of various sizes. Apparently, when you forget to water them for a bit, and then they get watered about every couple weeks, they decide to propagate like crazy.
Oh, that's interesting. So you have one mother bulb and a lot of babies.
In about 4 or 5 different pots. The biggest ones have their own, and then there's one long tray of small ones that are no bigger than a foot.
Amaryllis bulbs, of course, are a perennial Christmas time favorite, and these bulbs are pre-programmed to flower as soon as they start to come out of the box and get watered again. Now, amaryllis flowers, the flower stalk appears first, and then the flower stalk fades. You're supposed to cut off the little seed pods that form, and then out come the green leaves, and that's when you're supposed to water and feed the plant and let it get nice sun to recharge the leaves. But right around this time of year is when you need to put the plants in storage, let them go dormant, give them the rest that they need to send up the new flower stalk. Are these plants in dirt-filled pots?
They're in potting soil pots,
yeah,
with a little bit of compost mixed in. That's all the feeding they ever get.
That's good.
And remember, fertilizer.
Right. And you're going to come home at Christmas time?
Thanksgiving and then Christmas, yes.
Okay.
This is my last semester.
Well, what you want to do is just take these bulbs and put them in a cool, dry place. You can just leave them in their pots, or you can take them out of the pots if you want more work than you need to do. But they should go through their rest period now, ideally. This is the perfect time. So just put them in a cool, dark place. They shouldn't be watered. They shouldn't be cared for. And then after a rest of 2 or 3 months, then they should come out into bright indoor light and the watering process begin. And if everything worked out well, and you're lucky, they will send up their flowering stalks. Now, you realize the babies may take a couple of years before they reach flowering size, but they'll still come out of dormancy and send out the leaves, and that's when, of course, they need, you know, bright light and a light feeding and watering. But if you get the timing right, the mother bulb should flower for you right around the holidays.
I've never actually personally put them through a rest period. It's just they don't get watered for a while. It's never this long.
Well, that's...
I've been doing that by accident. So you think maybe I should put them in the basement until I leave. And when I come back, remove the dead leaves then, and everything should be fine.
Exactly. So, yeah, if you basically ignored them for a month or two at the right time of the year, you did it accidentally.
That works.
Success always works, and you always claim you know what you were doing. All right.
Yeah, as they find homes for the rest of the babies.
Oh, yeah, but get them to flowering size first. They'll make great gifts when you're a bankrupt college student trying to pay back your loans.
Very true. Thank you.
All right. Good luck in school.
Thanks. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be the guest speaker at the second annual Frenchtown Green Fair at 1 o'clock on Saturday, September 28th in Frenchtown, New Jersey. And I'll give a free talk explaining how to turn your fall leaves into garden gold at an event sponsored by the Lower Merion Conservancy at St. Joe's University on Wednesday, October 23rd at 6:30. But don't go looking for all the compost-rich details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to best fertilize that sweet, sweet corn this summer. I'm sweet, sweet Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops of salad greens, broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's sweet corn season, and we're going to celebrate by warming up the butter. No, well, actually, we are going to do that too, but we're going to tell you the best way to fertilize sweet corn. It's gotten a little difficult to do in this dicey, brave new world, but there are some nice ways to get a real nice set of corn for your summer eating. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Fred, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, boss. I was calling initially. Had a couple of questions on vines and trees, but I wanted to make a comment of a couple of shows before your lead-based paint concerns.
Right.
Are real for any inner city or almost anybody who's painted anything in this country through the late 50s and early 60s. Lead-based paint is not skin absorptive. Lead does not absorb in the skin. And so to handle this with your urban gardens and such isn't an issue, but it certainly is an issue. Lead is taken up by leafy vegetables, broadleaf vegetables. And so we've always been concerned about lead at least 3 to 5 feet off of a building, an old building that might have been painted, or a heavily traveled roadway. The lead that was in gasoline would come out and literally fall 10 to 15 feet off the roadway. It wouldn't go very far. The basic channels of lead poisoning for mostly in children is through eating it or breathing it. Dust.
Right. If I said that you should wear gloves so you don't get it through your skin, you're correct. I was technically wrong there. But obviously, one of the big ways lead gets into people's system, even more than eating certain vegetables, is when they work garden soil and disturb the lead. Then they inhale it. It's also been found in high degrees in carpeting when people work in gardens and bring the dirt in on their feet. Then the lead's in the house and it's constantly being aerosolized.
Well, that kind of clears that up a little bit. What I was concerned about is I have a bunch of trees and they all have vines on them. The East Coast vines all over the is just kind of taken over the woods in the last 20-50
years. Oh, Fred, where are you?
I'm up in Vermont.
Okay.
I'm more interested in just the relationship of vines to trees. Some of these vines are at least an inch in diameter. Some of them go up to 3 inches in diameter.
Yes.
And I just wonder how integral the root systems are with the trees. If I just go in and cut the vine, I just wonder how much I disturb the whole ecosystem.
You don't. You're saving the trees. These vines, as you note, are becoming a bigger problem all across the country as the climate warms and there's more carbon dioxide in the air. This seems to favor an explosive growth of these vines. Poison ivy not only is growing faster but becoming more potent. Wild grape is one of the ones that develops that real sinewy vine that actually becomes woody after time. And there's Virginia creeper out there. And the reason they're so prevalent underneath trees is most of these vines produce edible fruit, edible to birds. And the birds eat the berries in the fall. And of course, birds roost and live in trees. So they're constantly reseeding new vines under the trees. Luckily, in your part of the country, you don't have any parasitic vines. There aren't any vines that are taking nutrition from the tree through the trunk. But you're right. Down at ground level, they are competing for nutrients. So the solution is just to constantly keep cutting these vines off at ground level. You don't even have to pull them out of the tree. You don't have to dig them up. If you just cut the vine as it comes out of the ground and you stay at that for an entire season, not allowing the vine to really develop any leafy growth, it'll exhaust its root system, it'll exhaust its energy down there, and it'll die. And, of course, the stuff in the tree will turn brown and, you know, kind of fall out, or you can pull it out if it looks ugly. But you have to remember that birds are always going to be planting new vines, so it's always a constant struggle. This is a changing ecology. There may have been a time when the trees and the vines could live in harmony, but right now I fear that most of these vines, if left unchecked, will start killing off massive numbers of trees.
All right. Well, thanks, boss. I appreciate the information. Good show.
All right. Good luck, Fred. Thank you, sir. 1-888-346-9499. Joanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Joanne. How are you?
Great, thank you.
And where is Joanne Great?
In Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I'm actually not from here, but I've been gardening here the past 2 summers.
Okay, where are you from?
I'm from Boston, but I lived for a long time in Indiana, so most of my gardening experience is from Bloomington, Indiana.
Okay, very good. So what can we do for you?
Well, I have a question about what I've always called putting the garden to bed in the fall. and whether that should include fall tilling or not.
Oh, good Lord, no. Absolutely not.
I didn't think so. My normal procedure would be to spread the thick layer of shredded leaves in the fall and just leave it over winter. But I recently read someone suggesting that those should be tilled in the fall, but that didn't make sense to me, so I wanted to check with you.
That makes no sense for three reasons. First, every time you till your soil, you lose nutrients, the most ephemeral nutrient. And one of the most important nutrients in your soil is nitrogen. And when you mix up your soil and expose it to the atmosphere, a lot of that nitrogen goes and joins its nitrogenous cousins that are in the air we breathe. So you want to disturb your soil as little as possible to keep the nutrients in it. Second, tilling exposes weed seeds to light, the trigger for germination, and then buries them again as if you were planting them. So people who till have excessive weed problems compared to people who have built up a nice raised bed and just add compost and fresh soil to the surface every year. And third, fall leaves, shredded fall leaves, are to me the ultimate way to close the circle of gardening. If you can collect and shred enough leaves in the fall, you have everything you need to protect your garden over winter, to have mulch ready for the following season, and to make compost. But when you bury those leaves, even shredded, you take them out of the atmosphere and you put them into an anaerobic system. When you bury them, the decomposition slows down to the slowest possible rate. I mean, they would be like the newspapers they find in landfills from the 1960s if it weren't for the fact that worms in your soil want to work away at it. But you're absolutely correct. The way to prep your garden for winter is to pull up all the old dead plants and throw those in the compost as long as they're not diseased or anything. And then especially where you are, where you know the soil is going to freeze hard over the winter, 2 inches of shredded leaves on top of your garden is an excellent protection, because even the heaving and thawing of the soil that occurs during wintertime, you get those warm weeks in winter, and then it freezes up again, the soil starts to crack, and it starts to look like an ice floe. Every time that happens, you're losing nutrients. So, yeah, that's like putting it into a Tupperware container. You really seal the nutrients down in the soil. So what I do, for instance, when I'm smart, I have raised beds. And I tilled my raised beds like once 20 years ago when I built them. And since then, I just add compost to the surface and have a minimum of weed problems. What I do when I cover my beds with shredded leaves over the winter is as soon as it starts to be planting time and you get some sunny days, you go out and you just rake that leaf cover off to the side and allow the soil to warm up. The negative aspect of a wintertime mulch in your climate is it will keep the soil cooler longer if you don't remove it. So as soon as things warm up, you want to move that mulch off to the side. Then do your planting when the weather permits, and then put that mulch right back on top to prevent weeds. I'm guessing you're a flat earth gardener?
Yes, I am. I do mulch pretty heavily with straw throughout the growing season.
Oh, okay.
So there is already a layer of straw on the garden.
Okay. Well, straw would function the same way as shredded leaves, either one having something on the surface that breathes. The breathing is the most important part. Or we could cover our beds with tarps, but that just makes the soil sour. It's just mold and, you know, it doesn't allow air and water to do what they normally do.
Right. Okay.
But I would really urge you to at least experiment with creating 4x8 areas or areas that are no wider than 4 feet. They can be as long as you want, with 2-foot walking lanes in between, even if you don't make raised beds, but put up little lane markers or string or something, and you just walk in the 2-foot areas and never step on to the areas your plants are in, you'll find the need for tilling will vanish.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're okay. not stepping on the area where your plants are in. The only reason we till is to relieve soil compaction. So if you don't walk right. where your plants are growing, you don't compact the soil.
Okay, good. Well, then you've answered many of my questions today. You made my spring sound a lot easier and my fall sound a lot easier.
All right, Joanne, good luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mike. I love the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Natural sources of nitrogen for sweet corn. Sweet Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, would you sweetly read this week's question?
I would be happy to, Mike. We heard from Dave in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, who writes, I have a question about urea. I understand what it is in its natural form, and I understand its effect on plants. I have been struggling to grow sweet corn the last few years, and I'm sure the problem is the low nitrogen content in my soil. I have been adding compost, manure, and leaf mulch, but I just can't seem to get enough nitrogen to the corn. I've been thinking of also using urea, but I'm concerned that it's not as organic as suppliers would like you to believe. And I don't want any chemicals in my garden. Is urea safe? If not, is there another source of nitrogen I can use?
Well, I was going to say that urea has always been about as far from organic as you can get. As modern urea, used as you note as a high nitrogen fertilizer, is a synthetic chemical created in the 1820s using silver cyanide and ammonium chloride, a pretty nasty combination to my oh-so-organic ears. But a little more research learned me that urea was originally the name for the nitrogen content in our urine.
Right. Haven't you often referred to urea on the show as fake pee?
Ha! Yeah. And the synthetic version created quite a sensation in the scientific community, as it was the first time that something that naturally occurred in the human body was duplicated in the lab. Anyway, today's urea is that inorganic, artificially created compound. Used in agriculture, it's tremendously destructive. It destroys soil life and water supplies and contributes to soil erosion. And it has a close relative, ammonium nitrate, that finds its way outside of agriculture all too often to be used as a weapon of choice for terrorists. From those American losers who blew up the Oklahoma Federal Building in 1995 to the enemy forces attacking our troops with improvised explosive devices. All that carnage caused by a fertilizer that so-called conventional farmers use to grow corn.
I wish more people understood the link between chemical fertilizers and explosives. Maybe they'd think twice before using them so casually.
Boy, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? Anyway, corn is a heavy feeder, and like lawn grasses, mostly just wants nitrogen. One of the best organic sources is the corn gluten meal we always recommend as a lawn food. You just have to be aware that corn gluten meal also prevents the germination of seeds. Now, that use is intended to stop weed seeds, but it also prevents wanted seeds from germinating. So you would wait to use it until your corn had been up and growing for about 2 weeks, which is fine. All seeds contain a lot of plant food, so those babies are going to be just fine until then. After that, you can dust some corn gluten meal between the rows every couple of weeks. You'll feed your corn really well, and you'll prevent any late-blooming weed seeds from sprouting.
Our listener mentioned using manure, and boy, has the news about that been bad.
It really is a crying shame. Composted horse manure used to be a sweet corn fertilizer of choice. Lots of nitrogen, and once it's fully composted, few to no weed issues. But as we've been reporting, a new generation of persistent herbicides that can survive the composting process has made horse manure a dicey choice. Luckily, you can test the safety of fully composted horse manure by trying to sprout some pea seeds in it, like snow peas or snap peas. Peas are exceptionally vulnerable to these persistent herbicides. So if they come up and they look okay, the composted manure is safe to use. Also safe to use should be composted chicken manure from a small flock that's tended by intelligent beings. And chicken poop is even more nitrogen-rich than horse manure. But manure from, quote, conventionally raised chickens may contain arsenic, which makes being unconventional look better all the time.
But you're trying something new this year, right? Is it coffee grounds?
Yes, but with an asterisk. Coffee grounds can't be used straight as a fertilizer because they're much too acidic. But they are really high in nitrogen, and they're abundant. Coffee shops will give you all you want. So I have a bed of sweet corn growing that I've been feeding with coffee grounds, to which I've been adding some hardwood ash from our wood stove.
And how much wood ash do you need to add? What's the ideal ratio?
Ha! You know me. I have no idea. I'm just fooling around with this, eyeballing and ballparking the amounts. But so far, a couple of tablespoons of wood ash mixed into each quart of wet ground seems to be having the desired effect. I have big, healthy stalks with lots of pollen grains on top and an amazing amount of silks to receive that pollen.
Well, I can't wait until we can judge your success.
Well, those sure were some interesting options for high nitrogen fertilizing, now wasn't they? Luckily for yous, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, now my producer is threatening to swipe my sweet corn if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And please visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Lunas, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our super sweet staff includes editor Al Banks, production assistant Jolie Higassi, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm as sweet as it gets. And I'll come by sweetly again to see you next week. What can you do when hundreds of angry hornets are zeroed into your rear end? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll jack up the yellow jackets, plus your fabulous phone calls.